You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you so much for coming to the discussion on Zimbabwe. Greetings, colleagues in Washington. My name is Glenn Umpani. I'm with the Africa Regional Office. I'm going to be having a conversation this afternoon with Petina Kapa. Petina is one of is an OSI fellow who is currently working on a very interesting topic, trying to assess the whether Pentecostalism, in essence, does negatively affect promotion of an open society. And Petina is a Zimbabwean who has written extensively. She's an accomplished writer, a lawyer by profession, and she's a friend, and it's good to have her here this afternoon. And I discussed with Petina during the course of the weekend. We said, you know what, rather than you giving us a presentation, let's have a conversation on Zimbabwe, because I think we have heard a lot of people delivering speeches on Zimbabwe, but rarely do we hear people talking about Zimbabwe. So I think it's important for us to have a conversation on Zimbabwe. So I'm going to, since Petina is very conversant in terms of the developments in Zimbabwe, we are going to have a discussion on what is happening in Zimbabwe. And by the way, before I start, Petina, congratulations on the wedding of the Prime Minister. Do you have anything to say about that, Petina?
Well, let's just say it's the largest party I've ever been to in my life. I was at the wedding. I should say wedding in quotes, because as it turns out, it wasn't really a wedding. 1,500 people, and it was. Well, what is very interesting to me is that the people from the other side didn't really turn up. So I mean, we can say a lot about that issue, but you know, from a purely personal point of view, I think it's wonderful that he's met somebody that he likes enough to want to commit to.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as we are discussing this, Petina, on a more serious level, I know the country is currently going through a constitutional process with a preparation that the country will have an election after this constitutional process. And I think part of the challenge that I've always had looking at the Zimbabwean issue is the fact that there seems to be a whole lot of an effort to say, let's have a new constitution, as if the constitution in Zimbabwe is the real problem. Do you foresee the space opening up with a new constitution?
Okay, Glenn, if I may, maybe we should just step back a little bit and talk about why the constitution is so important. You know, Glenn and I are Zimbabweans by birth, and Julie, as I discovered, is a Zimbabwean by obsession, as is everyone in this room. But you know, let's just take a step back and talk about why the constitution is so important. Zimbabwe gained its independence in 1980, right? And at the time, the constitution that was agreed on is called the Lancaster House Constitution, because it was a negotiated document between, on the one side, the white minority regime of Ian Smith and his successors, on the other side, the British, and at the same time, the black Zimbabwean political leaders. So it was a negotiated document. And since its adoption in 1980, it has been amended 19 times. That's almost as many times as the American Constitution, but over a period of 32 years or so. And each amendment has more or less concentrated power in the executive. In 1987, Zimbabwe moved away from the Westminster model of government, you know, under which you have a prime minister that's appointed by parliament. And the prime minister is appointed on the basis of which party has the largest number of seats in parliament. So we moved away from that model to an executive presidency. But what we failed to do in the constitution is to balance out the other arms of government. So increasingly, with each amendment, power has been concentrated in the hands of the executive, to the point where the president can pretty much call an election anytime he chooses to, and he can appoint members of the, you know, people who run the elections can be appointed by the president, so that there really hasn't been that necessary balance that you want to see in a democracy. So one of the conditions that was agreed upon when this new government came into being in 2008 was that there had to be a new constitution. Because, of course, the realization was that the reason why Zimbabwe had had one contested election after another was because the constitution tilted too much power towards the executive. So that's why this constitution has become a crucial, crucial point of contention. Because one side knows very well that if Zimbabwe has a proper constitution with all the right checks and balances, they're going to lose power. And the other side knows that if Zimbabwe has such a constitution, they are more likely to get into office.
And I agree with what you're saying, Bettina, but part of my challenge is that whenever you've got two political parties that are in a contestation and they set on a path to draft a constitution, what we end up having is a document similar to what we had in 1980,
Absolutely.
Where it's a negotiated process.
Absolutely.
So that takes me back to my earlier question to simply say, will the constitution achieve the ideals of Zimbabweans to simply say, you know what, we want to open up democracy? Because now the constitution is now the center of the conflict. So
So
I don't know whether we will be able to come up with a constitution that can address the problems.
Yeah. Will the constitution manage to achieve what Zimbabweans want?
Yes.
I mean, if you define politicians as Zimbabweans, then then yes, the politicians will be very happy. But I think the bigger question is the constitution that's going to come out of this process reflective of the aspirations and the will of the people of Zimbabwe? I think absolutely not. Absolutely not. I'll give you one example, which is a contested issue, the question of land. The way they've dealt with land in this constitution is to try and protect those who benefited from the land reform program. Basically, people affiliated with ZANU-PF who benefited, right? The ones who got, you know, large tracts of land and so on. At the same time, they don't want to compensate the white farmers whose land was taken. So basically, there's a legalization of racism. You have a Section 16 that says, if the government takes land away from an indigenous Zimbabwean, such land should be compensated to the value of the land. But if the land is taken away from a non-indigenous Zimbabwean, that person gets only the value of the improvements. So there's definitely discrimination there. There's definitely, and then you have Section 4, which has a catch-all non-discrimination phrase that says, yes, there shall be no discrimination on the basis of race, gender, tribe, all the wonderful things. Except when it's necessary, you know, except when it's necessary. And it's going to be extremely difficult. I mean, if this constitution is adopted as it is, it's going to be extremely difficult to amend this because those two sections can only be changed at a referendum.
So from the way that you look at it, you have said that this document will not be reflective of the aspirations of Zimbabwe. Do you foresee the document being adopted at the next referendum?
I think if all the political parties campaign for it to be adopted, I think it will be. Of course, you have civil society that is campaigning against it. By the way, the land issue is not the only contentious or problematic issue in the constitution. There's also the death penalty issue. I mean, one would have thought in 2012, when most countries in the world are moving away from the death penalty, Zimbabwe would have dropped it. But there's a very strange clause that says no death penalty in Zimbabwe for people who are over the age of 72, under the age of 18, and women. So, of course, Zimbabweans being what they are terrified that, you know, gangs of men are now going to be getting women to do their murders for them, you know. But, you know, we had hoped, I mean, you know, all progressive people in Zimbabwe and had hoped that we would move away from the death penalty. And even the chief's council, you know, the traditional leaders, they don't want the death penalty because they consider it an African, you know, because in traditional African culture, you didn't kill people, you know, in order to make the point that killing people is wrong. So that's also one of the issues. And then there's some very strange things that they've done to advance the cause of women. So there are these special seats that have been set aside for women in parliament, seats that don't have to be contested. And on the one hand, you think, well, this is a good thing, because of course, you know, the political terrain isn't very kind to women. But at the same time, there's something incredibly condescending about having 60 seats set aside specially for women. You know.
So why is ZANU-PF flagging a lot the issue of sexual minorities?
Oh.
How is it reflected in the constitution?
Yeah. That's another very interesting question. You know, one step that I should have emphasized in my introductory remarks is that in 1999, thereabouts, 2000, there was an attempt to come up with a new constitution. It was actually a far more progressive document than this one, and that was a ZANU-PF-led attempt. There was a national constitutional committee that was set up, made up of intellectuals and scholars, and you were, intellectuals and Glenn.
That's a good one.
So, I mean, one of the really progressive things that came out of that constitution is that there was a very clever and cleverly worded phrase that said there shall be no discrimination on the basis of natural differences. And of course, that was a way to get, you know, gay rights, lesbian rights protected in the Constitution. Because if it's a natural difference, you can't be discriminated on the basis of that natural difference. And nobody seemed to actually understand, you know, nobody seemed to notice this. And it pretty much sailed through. But unfortunately, at a referendum, that Constitution failed to pass the test for other reasons, nothing to do with the content itself. So what happened initially in April, I believe it was, when the first draft of this constitution was leaked to the press, that natural differences language was in there. And then the very same people who had included that language in the previous constitution, Jonathan Moyo and so on, then caused such a row and said, we have to take this out because you are trying to sneak in gay rights into the constitution. Right, so that was taken out. And now you have a clause that says marriage shall mean marriage between a man and, you know, people of the opposite sex, basically. A man and several women, a man and one woman. Because, of course, we allow polygamy. God forbid that gay people want to marry, but polygamy is okay, right? So what has now happened, though, is that there's this narrative around gay rights in the Constitution, right? There's a very vociferous crowd that is saying this constitution protects gay rights. And why? Because there's no clause in the constitution that says there shall be no gay rights. That's basically what they're looking for. That's basically what they want to see in the constitution. But of course, you can't have that. You can't have a clause like that in a constitution. And if effectively, what you'd be doing is to make a party policy part of the constitution. You know, ZANU-PF's party policy is that they do not want to protect gay rights. ZANU-PF's party policy is that they want this policy of indigenization. And they want to put those party policies into the constitution where really they don't belong.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, that on the constitution, Bettina. So you have highlighted that the constitution is part of the global political agreement that the two political parties have signed. And you have indicated that you don't think this is going to be reflective of the will of the people of Zimbabwe. Next year, they are going to go for an election.
Mm.
Do you think there is going to be an outright winner that is going to come out of it? What are the chances that we are not going to have a similar problem recurring after an election where there's disagreement on the results?
Okay. I'm going to preface my next remarks by saying that it's extremely difficult to poll a country like Zimbabwe. It's extremely difficult to conduct a public poll. Mm. But there was a public poll that was conducted recently by Freedom House, you know, together with the mass media...
Mass Public Opinion Institute,
yeah. And their findings were rather scary. They found that in the period between 2010 and 2012, support for ZANU-PF had increased, but support for the MPC had declined. But tellingly, 41% of the people polled refused to indicate support for any party. So that's almost half of the people that were polled. And I think that's very interesting. It was very interesting to watch the reaction of the MDC to this poll, because they refused adamantly to accept it as credible. Because, of course, you know, it's bad news for them. But I think that there's something very interesting that's happening in Zimbabwe. What's happening in Zimbabwe is that the MDC now is in government, and their record is now, you know, is there for everyone to examine, to scrutinize. Before, they were a political movement on the outside. Now they're on the inside, they're part of the establishment. And they've suffered from being on the inside. So they are associated with some of the failures of this government. So I think that's a factor in this poll result. And then there's also the fact that, you know, the MDC has always been a coalition of groups and interests opposed to ZANU-PF. And I'm not sure that is enough anymore. I'm not sure that that is enough.
Petina, before you go, you know, I really want to deal with this question.
Mm.
Every time when we assess the MDC, we always assess the MDC in comparison with the ZANU-PF.
Yeah.
Can you give me an assessment of what you think about the MDC themselves, independent of ZANU-PF, what they have done? That, because I think this is where the challenge to simply say, them being part of the government, what have they done individually in terms of addressing issues of integrity in leadership, addressing issues of corruption as individuals? How have they performed in the little space that they have as a political party?
Yeah.
That might, to a large extent, have caused the support that they have to be eroded. Because if I look at the Freedom House, 41% of Zimbabweans don't trust the Prime Minister's office, and he's the one who occupies that office.
Yeah.
Why is it so?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think it's a question that Zimbabweans are starting to ask themselves more and more. You're absolutely right that we've always defined the MDC as being, you know, as in opposition to ZANU-PF, right? I had a brilliant Facebook discussion where we said basically the choices that Zimbabwe faces are that you have a president who's a philanderer or a president who's a murderer. I mean, which one are you going to go for? But I think it's very important to, as you say, examine the MDC's record on its own merits. And I mean, if you look at what the MDC has achieved, well, education, which is not controlled by the large MDC, but by the smaller MDC. I mean, education is one of the big things that this government has achieved. Before 2008, I mean, you and you know, his team will probably know this better than I do, but before 2008, the textbook ratio, the textbook to child ratio, was extremely, extremely high. But when UNICEF came in, working with Minister Coulthard in the Ministry of Education, they have managed to reduce that ratio, and every child now has all the textbooks that are needed for school. So that's one major achievement. What are the other major achievements? It's extremely difficult to say this is really what they've done, because part of the limitations that they have as a government is that cabinet is you know,
collective.
Is collective. And so decisions have to be taken collectively.
Okay, what about failures at the council level? They control city councils across the country. What have they
not? That is actually the biggest scandal. I think what's happening at the council level, at the local government level, is actually is a much bigger scandal than what's happening at the national level. Because at the national level, you can say, well, these decisions are collective, and you know, the blame and the success are shared collectively. But you're absolutely right to say at the council levels there's been massive corruption. You know, the deputy mayor of Harare has, you know, built this massive mansion, and he has all these cars and, you know, a very lavish lifestyle. And then when he's asked, how did you get this money, where did the money come from, he says, you know, it came from well wishers. You know, and then there's a lot of, and there's a lot of construction in wetlands. You know, in a wetland is an environmentally protected area, but there's a lot of sudden construction in wetlands, and a lot of very dodgy people coming in with development projects. And so I think at the local government level, there's absolutely no trust at all, because the MDC has absolutely failed. They failed to rein in corruption. They failed to deliver on any of their promises.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the local government level.
But so what would you attribute that to? Do you attribute it to a lack of clarity in terms of what they want to do when they get into government, or there are other factors beyond that that they cannot deal with in terms of where their space that they occupy?
Oh gosh, you know, we could talk all afternoon about why the MDC is failing, but one of the basic reasons, you know, when you talk to diplomats in Zimbabwe about, you know, the all these failures, The consistent response is, oh, but they're so brave. They're very brave. They're very brave. Well, yes, they are. They're extremely brave people. But that's all well and good. But are they competent people?
Mm.
And I think what has happened is that the MDC has rewarded bravery over competence. You know, people who are able to rush out into the street and throw stones at the police and so on. And as a result, you know, the Prime Minister is very much, what is the word for it? He's patronage-driven as well. He will reward loyalty rather than competence. And so I think the very basic human resource question is that the MDC simply does not have the right people in the right positions, right? They have loyal people. They have brave people, but they're not necessarily competent people. So that's one,
mm-hmm.
right? And then I think another factor as well is that there really doesn't seem to be a coherent policy, they aren't really following any coherent policy as MDC in government.
Before you go into the policy issue, I would want you to respond to the policy issues, and because two issues have been problematic when you deal with the Zimbabwean issue. There's been the issue of indigenization in terms of saying where does the MDC stand on indigenization. Can you speak more broadly in terms of the indigenization debate in Zimbabwe and in terms of where the two political parties stand in terms of indigenization and what is the policy of the MDC in regarding to that? And then talk about the issues of resources, the issues of diamonds.
Yep.
What are the positions that are there? And so, because I think that is one area where we have failed to get clarity in terms of ZANU-PF is very clear about what they want to do. Whether, regardless that it's outrageous, but there's clarity on that. And where I failed to get clarity is the positions that MDC articulates in terms of these issues of indigenization, issues of resources.
That's really good. I'll come to that. But I just want to just develop my little point on the MDC in government a little bit further and say the MDC on paper is a social democratic party. We have not seen any of that in any of the things that they've done in government. We have seen more reaction to events, reaction to things, rather than a policy-driven approach. You know, so that's definitely one. And I think part of it is that, because as I said before, the MDC is a coalition of interests. Honestly, the social democracy part of it has just sort of like fallen by the wayside, and now the interest is really about we're not ZANU-PF. Vote for us, we're not ZANU-PF. It's not that we have any particular policy. Because if they were truly a social democratic party, they would have a far more consistent policy on indigenization. Indigenization, for those who don't know, is Zimbabwe's version to the black economic empowerment in South Africa. The idea is that the economy is controlled by foreign sources, and so it is time for, you know, black Zimbabweans, indigenous Zimbabweans, to take control. And it's a very cleverly worded policy because it's not racist as such. Indigenous Zimbabwean is any Zimbabwean who was previously disadvantaged, right? So if you can show that you were previously disadvantaged, you benefit from indigenization. So you could be white, and if you show that somehow you were previously disadvantaged, you could actually benefit. But of course, in reality, it simply means that, you know, indigenous Zimbabweans are black, and, you know, some mixed race Zimbabweans, and maybe a few Zimbabweans of Asian origin. So if the MDC really were a social democratic party, I think they would have a much more robust and much more committed position on this, because in theory it looks fair. I mean, which country wants to be completely owned by foreigners? You know, on the surface, it looks like an excellent policy. But what has actually happened is very similar to what happened with the land reform, that it's been hijacked by certain interests within ZANU-PF, and it's been hijacked to the detriment of ordinary Zimbabweans, and it's only the wealthier and the people who already have wealth who are actually benefiting. The banks, for instance. You know, we have so many local indigenous banks. I don't understand why it's necessary to take over Barclays Bank. You know, so now there's a big conflict between a young man called the Minister of Indigenization, Xavier Kasukwere, and the Governor of the Reserve Bank on this very question of banks, because the banking sector is already indigenized. You know, it's open to anybody to set up a bank. So why would you then need to go and take a bank that's already existing? So these are some of the questions that I feel that the MDC hasn't really come out strongly enough to articulate their position.
Oh, that's good. And then, Bettina, the other issue that I would want to move away from this issue is to discuss the issue of the elections that have been talked about, that they're going to be held in 2013. I was fortunate in 2008 to work with NDI on elections in Zimbabwe, and I think after working with them for 6 months, part of what I realized was to simply say, no matter if you get a good constitution, you get good systems in place, unless the political culture in the country changes, you will not have a free and fair election.
Yeah.
So my question is, what guarantee do we have that in 2013 we will not have a 2008?
Very short answer, none.
So why?
We have no guarantee.
So is it not time for people to think beyond the current models? Because there are two things that happen in Zimbabwe. Saying that we externalize our problem. We push South Africa to say South Africa should do something. SADC should do something about it. The international world should do something about it. Is there a depth of internal solutions to deal with the crisis? other than the electoral route?
No, no, it's something that I've been grappling with, I have to say, because, you know, every time something happens, every time there's some kind of deadlock, we immediately say, oh, we have to go outside. South Africa has to come in. The international community has to come in. But, of course, there are some questions that, by their very nature, are not capable of an international solution. And this is certainly one of them, I believe. One solution that has been doing the rounds, pushed by people like Ibo Mandaza and, you know, people who are sort of like on the fence, is that we have another GNU. So we have a GNU round two. We have another coalition government. I am honestly not entirely sanguine about that particular solution. I don't think it's a solution, because what really the GNU has done, as we have seen from both parties, is simply to make the lives of a few ministers much more comfortable than they were, you know, 4 years ago. So I really don't think that another GNU is a solution. At the same time, I recognize everything that you say about the danger of elections. I mean, Zimbabwe is probably the only country in the world where elections are dangerous. I mean, for heaven's sake, people are scared of an election. And it really shouldn't be that way. But beyond those two, I don't really know what other solution there can be. I think that we have to find ways and fight for any election to be a fair election, to be a clean election, a non-violent election. But that's why the Constitution becomes so important.
You know, I heard this, and I think you might give us an authoritative view on it. There is now a thinking around that people entertain a view that they can actually be a reformed ZANU-PF, that can actually be able to lead Zimbabwe as an alternative to MDC, having shown some weaknesses in terms of the leadership. What do you think about it?
You know, this is a very interesting motif that's arisen in the last 2 years or so, and it's particularly attractive to diplomats in Harare. They love the idea of a reformed ZANU-PF because they're so disappointed by the MDC. But you know, we talk about, and I've been talking about ZANU-PF like it's one party, one monolithic, you know, entity. But ZANU-PF is very interesting because it's so divided and it's so multifarious, if you like. There's so many versions of ZANU-PF. One of the hardest working ministers in ZANU-PF, who is really absolutely an absolute star in the cabinet, is a man called Walter Mzembe. He's a tourism minister. And he has been linked to this reformed ZANU-PF. And there are a few other people. It's very interesting that the hardworking ZANU-PF ministers are the ones most often associated with this reform agenda. But I have to say that I don't really know enough about the internal dynamics of ZANU-PF to tell you whether there is really a possibility of this reform and whether this reformed ZANU-PF can actually deliver, you know.
Then there's one angle where we, as a foundation, work with a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about civil society in Zimbabwe? The first question that I want to ask, is there a civil society in Zimbabwe? Is there a civil society in Zimbabwe?
Oh, man, this thing is being recorded, right? And I'm very, very sorry to disappoint all of you wonderful people in this room who have been doing so much to fund civil society in Zimbabwe. But, you know, it's extremely discouraging what's happening to civil society in Zimbabwe. I think as a sort of a neutral observer, one of the things that disappoints me is that civil society hasn't taken the MDC to task enough. That to me is just incredibly shocking. You know, I accept that, you know, when the MDC was in opposition, civil society was working hand in hand with the opposition to bring democracy to Zimbabwe. But since the MDC has been in power, you know, there have been almost no voices coming from civil society to say, hang on, this is not actually why we worked with you. This is not why we put you into office. I got into trouble in 2008 when I wrote a column in which I said civil society should now be the opposition in Zimbabwe, because we have no opposition. We have a coalition government. And I expected civil society to take on that task in the very same way that it had been taking ZANU-PF to task. I expected them to take this coalition government to task, but that didn't happen. So civil society has become extremely supine. It's almost like they can't, you know, they don't have the courage to take on the coalition government. And that to me has been extremely disappointing.
What do you attribute that to? What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think there's a... Again, I'll go back to the B word, brave. I mean, there's some incredibly brave people in Zimbabwe, in the civil society, in the MDC, who have invested a lot personally a lot personally, and who have lost a lot. And I think from a very human level, it's extremely disappointing when the thing that you thought you were fighting for doesn't happen. So sometimes you just step back and you decide, you know what, I'm going to save my powder for another battle. But I think that's the wrong approach to take in this particular case. And of course, a lot of friendships have been made across, you know, across the lines. You know, opposition figures, you know, civil society figures have developed very close networks. And sometimes it's very difficult to step back from those friendships and be critical. You know, so I think those are some of the factors.